Today we're going to discuss the superfluid again. As we did in the past with ferromagnets, when we started with a discussion first of linear waves and then switched to nonlinear solitons, there'll be a similar development today. We talked about waves in the superfluid that gave rise to elementary particles. We calculated their energy-momentum relation and saw how it's modified by interactions, allowing for the lack of viscosity or superfluidity. And today we're going to discuss nonlinear solitons in the superfluid, which are known as vortices. They're similar to vortices in an easy plane ferromagnet, which we dealt with briefly. And we'll discuss the role of vortices in the properties of superfluids. It turns out that in particular in two spatial dimensions, vortices have a large significance for the thermodynamics of a superfluid. In fact, they control a phase transition from a state with exponentially decaying correlations to a state with power law correlations. So this is roughly an outline of today's lecture. So I'll start with a reminder that we can calculate the thermodynamical properties of a system by using its partition function, which is basically taking the trace of its the exponential of its action over all degrees of freedom. And so in the case of a field, what we have to do is integrate over all possible states of the field. And that's a path integral written here. The action is the integral of the Lagrangian density over space and time. And that would be something like this, where you have two terms. One is the kinematic term, and the other is a potential energy that depends on everything about the field except the time derivatives. So the field itself and the gradient of the field into the potential energy, and the dynamics comes from this piece. For the purposes of thermodynamics, if we're working at a finite temperature T, this integral is taken along the imaginary time direction. So you can imagine real time and imaginary time. So we're going from 0 to minus IH bar divided by KBT, or minus IH bar beta, which is an imaginary time interval. Right, so I presume that you did this in the quantum field theory course previously. Right, good. So doing this integral over possible paths of a field with this unharmonic action, where the unharmonic terms are hidden in the potential energy. So U would be something like H bar squared over 2m grad psi star dot grad psi. And then there would be an interaction piece, J psi star squared psi squared, and a chemical potential piece. This is clearly not an option. We don't know how to work exactly with actions of this sort. So we're going to dumb down this theory a little bit to make it solvable. What else is a theoretical physicist to do? You have to devise an approximation. Right? And so we'll devise an approximation, and the approximation will be twofold. So we'll perform here two steps. One would be to go from a field theory in d plus one dimensions, d spatial dimensions and one time dimension, to a theory with just d dimensions. So this would be a classical field theory instead of a quantum field theory. And the other approximation would be to focus on the softest mode, which is variations of the phase angle, and forget about the fluctuations of the amplitude of the field psi, which is pretty much fixed by the competition of these two terms, right? So it'll be set close to some value. So both approximations turn out to be reasonable, and many properties of a superfluid that can be experimentally measured will be described by the simplified theory. So first we go from a quantum field theory in D plus one to a classical one in D dimensions. So first let me rewrite this using explicitly an imaginary time variable minus I tau, which goes between zero and h bar beta. And then my action would be I tau, it would be just tau. So this would be integral d tau from 0 to h bar beta ddr. Here I'll have I h bar psi star. I have d psi dt, and so now I will have to make it d psi d minus I tau. So the I will cancel out, and there will be an extra minus sign here, minus the potential energy term. And so that would be minus something that we call SE, the Euclidean action, or SE is this. Because we're talking about a phase transition at the end of the day, which happens at a finite temperature. And it turns out that the systematics of a thermal phase transition is governed by classical fluctuations. So you can focus just on the classical part and ignore the quantum part. And I'll explain exactly what I mean by the classical and quantum part here. Right? So if you look at this expression, you have a field psi that depends on r and tau. And you can expand it in the Fourier series and in the time direction, which would be something like this. It would be the sum of psi n of r times e to minus I omega n tau, where the frequencies are 2 pi n divided by beta, or h bar beta. These are known as the Matsubara frequencies. So if we only focus on the n equals zero term, so n are integers, then these would be terms that are independent of time. So if we just look at the n equals zero term. So the rest of the terms corresponds to quantum corrections to this classical case, and we'll see why. If we just say that psi is tau independent, which is equivalent to what I just did, right, so just keeping the n equals zero term is equivalent to assuming that, then this term will go away because there is no tau dependence. And since psi is independent of tau in the potential energy density, the integration over tau becomes trivial. So this will be just multiplication by h bar beta. So that's h bar beta times the integral ddr times u, which is a function of psi and its gradient. So then it turns out that the partition function can be approximated. This is an approximation now, as a path integral e to minus the Euclidean action divided by h bar. So the approximation is at this step, right? So that's still exact. So it will be the exponential of minus beta times the integral ddr u that depends on psi star, and the gradients. So this is just the Boltzmann weight. And it's specified for a classical field psi of r with no time dependence. So this is just classical statistical mechanics. So that's our first approximation. And u is written out over there. We might also express psi as the product of the square root of the density times the exponential of the phase of the field. And then the potential energy density will be expressed in terms of these quantities. So I'll remind you that we had the following result yesterday. So we have the gradient of density as well as the gradient of the angle. Plus these two terms. So theta is the softest angle and the softest field of the two because it only has a gradient squared term. So if theta deviates from some ground state uniformly everywhere, you pay no energy whatsoever. Right. So it's equivalent. So I'm just saying I'm making the approximation. So I'm not saying why. Right? So we're just going from a quantum field theory to a classical field theory, which must be easier to do. The question is whether it will describe adequately whatever we're trying to describe. And at the end of the day, what we're trying to describe is a phase transition between two states at a finite temperature. And it turns out that it's the classical fluctuations, the ones without the time dependence in the imaginary direction that dominate that. So that's the short answer. The long answer would take a while to develop. Okay, so theta is a soft field. And n is a hard field because in addition to the gradient term, it has something that clamps it near a certain value, right? So these two terms have a preferred value of n equal to mu divided by j, at which, around which the energy has a minimum. If you reduce n from this best configuration or increase it from this best configuration, the energy is going up, right? And so you want to be near this value. And so n is not allowed to move too far away from this value. So it's in this sense that this mode is hard, right? So it's clamped down. And if you imagine that you're at a finite temperature, right, so the profile of the energy as a function of density is like this. Right, so if you're at low temperatures, then you're just going to allow this field to fluctuate near this value. And these fluctuations presumably are not particularly important. So what we're going to do next is we're going to ignore entirely the field n and concentrate on the field theta, which is allowed to wander away from its uniform value that's adopted by the system somewhere, right? So we're going to neglect this and neglect that, assume that the concentration is approximately that, and just work with the remainder, right? So we just have a single field left in the theory. So beta times u would be h bar squared n divided by 2m, kbt in the denominator, and it would be grad theta squared. So I can write this as some coupling constant times grad theta squared. The coupling constant will control the strength of the fluctuations of theta, right? The larger the coupling constant, the smaller the fluctuations will be. And this coupling constant can be tuned experimentally, right? So as you can see, there are two handles that you can use to control that. One would be temperature. You can increase and decrease temperature. With liquid helium, there's not much of a range that you can attain with that, because if you go above the lambda temperature, then superfluidity is lost. But you can also control the superfluid density. So for example, if you make a two-dimensional sample, so imagine pouring a little bit of liquid helium on a substrate, you will have a two-dimensional sample, and the thickness of the helium film will control the two-dimensional density of particles there, right? So you can do something like that. In fact, experiments have been done precisely like so, except the surface was not flat, and experimentalists used Vicor glass, which is a very porous substance. So you can have superfluid helium coat the pores, and depending on how much helium you inject, you have different coverages and you have different two-dimensional density. So we have this experimental system, and we're now developing a theory for this experimental system. All right. So our partition function can now be evaluated in the following way. This is just a path integral in the classical field theory of something that looks rather simple. So it's that. What kind of a theory is this? And can we deal with it? What makes us so sure in our abilities? It's a Gaussian theory, right? It's a quadratic action, quadratic and theta. And so presumably we can do anything we want, particularly if we switch from real space to Fourier transform. And if we write theta of r as a sum of plane waves, theta k e to I k dot r. And then what we have in the exponential will be k over 2 times the sum of our momenta, k squared theta k squared. Right? So it's a simple theory, and we can obtain everything. In fact, this is the topic of your tutorial this week, the second tutorial of the week. So it looks simple enough, and in principle, it could be done in the next 10 minutes, or you can do it in your tutorial at your leisure. But it turns out that the situation is a little bit more complicated than this. What is missing from this description? What we're forgetting is that theta is an angular variable, and that values of theta are only defined modulo 2 pi. And in principle, you can have interesting configurations where theta is not even single valued, and it will not be captured by an expansion like this. Right? An expansion like this gives you smooth variations of theta without any singularities. But I can easily draw a situation where theta would be singular, necessarily singular at some point. Right? And imagine a configuration like this where e to I theta of r is given by the following expression. It's going to be x plus iy divided by the absolute value of x plus iy. So I'm doing it in two dimensions. In fact, in what follows, we will focus on the case of two spatial dimensions because their vortices play the most important role. In one dimension, you cannot have vortices. And in three dimensions, vortices do play a role, but it's a bit more complicated to deal with them. So if I look at the phase angle theta, in this direction, it's going to be theta equal to 0, right? And in this direction, theta would be pi over 4, pi over 2, pi, 3 pi over 2, and then as I come here, theta would be 2 pi. Of course, the jump from 0 to 2 pi doesn't count if we use this under the exponential, but for theta itself, it certainly makes a difference. Furthermore, there are also consequences for this field, or for the field psi of r, which is the square root of n times e to I theta. If I examine the situation closer and closer to the origin. So for instance, as I go around like this, I just know that the angle is increasing as I'm moving in the counterclockwise direction. And in fact, this is the direction of the gradient of theta. As I come closer to the origin, I still have the same story. Theta winds by exactly 2 pi as I go around the center. And when I come to the center, theta is undefined. So in fact, if I look at psi, what would happen to psi at the origin if I have strictly this configuration? Maybe psi is 0 there, right? So for now, we're going to sweep it under the rug and not think much about it. But we will be forced to come back and re-examine the situation. As theorists, we just try to ignore the warning signs as long as possible, but no longer than necessary. Sometimes you have to heed them, and we'll have to heed this warning sign, it turns out. For now, though, let's just think about the energy of this configuration. Let's evaluate the energy of a vortex. So beta u, I'm going to measure energy in the units of kbt. So that's what this thing is, right? It's dimensionless energy. It's k over 2 times the integral d to r grad theta squared. And grad theta in this configuration is easy to figure out. As you go around the circumference, whose length is 2 pi r, the angle changes by 2 pi. So the gradient of theta would be 2 pi divided by 2 pi r, which is 1 over r. Right. So grad theta, in absolute terms, is going to be 1 over r. So I'm going to plug that in and obtain d to r 1 over r squared. So let's switch to polar coordinates. I have integration over the azimuthal angle, which just gives me 2 pi. And then there's r dr. 1 over r squared. So it's pi k times the integral from 0 to infinity dr divided by r. So it has come back to bite us. The integral diverges. In fact, we have to regularize it at both the lower limit and the upper limit because the divergence is logarithmic. It's not a power. So it's bad on both ends, right? So we'll have to introduce some cutoffs, which we'll call RS for short and R long RL. In that case, the energy of the vortex would be something like this, R sub L divided by R sub S. So
just thank you. I have a question. Is dimensional regularization used to study vortices, say in dimensions 2 plus epsilon? Do such theories exist?
Well, theories are interesting things, right? Yeah. It's like, do numbers exist? It's a philosophical question. But here we don't need dimensional regularization because we have physical parameters that regularize the theory.
example in like silicon does it even exist if you like in a well-defined notion if you don't have an integer dimension?
Well, let's not open this can of worms. We're in two dimensions safely on, you know, on the ground. So can you guess what these links will be that provide us with the short and long distance cutoffs? Okay, very good. So the long distance cutoff is presumably are the size of the system. What about the short distance cutoff? The size of helium atom. Anybody else? So it turns out that if we go back to our original theory, we can actually find a length scale in it. And that's associated with the massive field M. If it's massive, it has a length scale. You can cook up a length scale out of a mass. So here's how it goes. If you back to the full, to the theory of phi, of psi, right? So the classical one. We have potential energy that's written over there. And if you imagine doing the following. So suppose I take my system, so I'm in two dimensions, and I'm going to make it normal to the left. So psi is going to be 0 here. All the way up to the y-axis, and then psi should recover to its equilibrium value on the right-hand side. So I have a boundary condition that psi of x is 0, and then psi of 0 is, and y is 0, and then psi of plus infinity and y is going to be whatever square root of n 0 times e to I theta. I can solve this problem how? The superfluid density recovers from 0 on the left-hand side to its normal value on the right-hand side. So this is x and this is y. And so I'm just making this part normal somehow. Maybe I warmed up this part and it's cold on this side or something like that. So somehow I suppressed superfluidity here and psi goes from 0 to a finite value here. And I can show that psi would depend on x in the following way. This would be the square root of n 0 times e to I theta times the hyperbolic tangent of x divided by some length scale c, which I can cook up just by looking at this equation. Right? So if I compare, for instance, the dimensions of these two terms, they're the same. And so since I have two powers of the gradient here, you can think of the gradients as 1 over c each. Right? And so you will have the same dimensions of the terms h bar squared over 2m times c minus 2 is going to equal g. So I have n here. Gn squared divided by 2 or something like that. Just dimensional analysis. You take two terms in your energy, and you know that they have the same dimension. And so then you can cancel the factors of 2 and then move xi to the right-hand side. Xi squared would be h bar squared divided by m, g, and n. And so xi is going to be the square root of that. So this is not going to be the size of the helium atom. It's a bit longer than that because it depends on the density, right? So as you reduce the density, you're going to have a longer and longer length over which the superfluid fraction recovers. It also depends on the interaction strength. So the weaker the interactions, the longer this length scale is. So that's our length scale. So the short distance cutoff is going to be this length c. Which is that. So if you draw the picture of the superfluid density around the vortex, here's what it'll look like. Okay, this would be the distance from the core, and this would be the density of the superfluid, psi squared. So it's going to increase like this, and then saturate at the value n zero. Okay, and this length scale is C. There's another way to estimate the size, and it's to remember that superfluidity is lost if the fluid is moving at a high velocity. Right? This is something that we concluded yesterday, although we thought about an object moving through a superfluid. And if the object was moving too fast, then it would lose, it would break the property of superfluidity. Right? There will be some viscosity. Or you can imagine a fluid moving through a pipe, and it's the same thing as the pipe moving relative to the fluid. So if the fluid is moving too fast, superfluidity is lost, right? And so we had the criterion that the velocity of motion has to be slower than the special speed that we calculated to be g times n divided by m, if I remember correctly. Right? So that was the velocity of quasiparticles at low low momentum. So if you think about a vortex, so here's the vortex core, and then gradient of theta points in this direction. You can calculate the velocity of the superfluid in the following way. In a plane wave with wave number k, momentum is h bar k, right? So here you can think of grad theta as k. This is how fast the phase changes, right? And so the velocity would be h bar k divided by the mass. And so it's h bar times grad theta divided by the mass. Right? The gradient of theta at the distance r from the vortex core is going to be 1 over r. So it's h bar divided by mr. And presumably when this is equal to s, then so v at c is going to be s. So the fluid will be moving faster and faster as you're approaching the core. And so at some point, it has to become normal instead of superfluid. So that's the criterion. We can see what this gives us. So we'll have s equal to h bar divided by m c. And so c would be h bar divided by m s. So it's h bar divided by mass times square root of gn over m. So we recover the same result as above.
Is this picture of this plot the top of psi? Is that, that's at odds of this picture? Is it? I mean, shouldn't it be zero at some disk around the origin?
Well, it's not zero in the disk. The superfluid density goes down gradually to zero.
Right, but that's different from this half plane, right?
Well, there I just was estimating the size, right? So
right.
It's a different experiment.
If you were to draw this in 2D.
So roughly speaking, it's here at the negative r where it vanishes.
What is the physical picture that I should have? Like, I put some helium in the surface here, I'm going to have the horses appearing, or they're going to appear like the same way as normal fluids. When you move something through the fluid, you have like those.
No, both. If you just let the superfluid alone, thermal fluctuations will create vortices, right? Mm-hmm. So we just calculated the energy of a vortex. It depends on the system size. So in a big system, having a single vortex will be extremely hard because the energy would diverge with the system size. But it turns out that if you have vortices and anti-vortices, then the dependence on the system size will cancel out. And you will have a finite energy for a vortex, which will be roughly dependent on the distance between the vortices.
So they have like an internal dynamics? They behave like particles? Maybe?
They will behave like particles. They will interact, and they will kick each other around. And so at a finite temperature, you'll just have a certain concentration of vortices. At the center, it's a normal fluid, right? At the very center, there's no superfluid at all, and the superfluid fraction rises as you go away from the core, gradually.
Right, is it because of the speed of
vortex? Yeah, it's speeding very fast, yes.
If the fluid has higher density outside, is there any kind of osmotic process that tends to collapse the vortex, or like?
Well, there still is fluid inside, it's just a normal fluid. There's no superfluid component, but the normal component is there. Right. So the total density doesn't change. So it's still filled with helium, except this helium has lost its superfluidity at the center. Okay. Good. So we've figured out that the vortex has these interesting properties. So now we're going to make some formal developments and separate our variables, separate our thermal fluctuations of the field into two parts, one of which are gentle waves, smooth waves like the ones described over here, and the other part will be vortices. So our next step is to separate our angular field into two parts, one containing idealized vertices without any other perturbations, and the other containing just waves. So these are smooth parts, and this part contains singularities of the cores. And we will see that at the end of the day, the energy can be written as a completely separate term for vortices and a term for waves. The term for waves will be precisely what we've written before. So I'm now doing it in two dimensions. And you can legitimately expand theta waves in the Fourier transform and deal with it as you will do in your tutorial. And the question is, what is the energy of the vortices alone and whether the vortices and the waves interact, right? So I haven't written a cross term that might have both. So we'll see that there is no interaction between them. So it's a very nice theory from a, just for the theory's sake, it's a very nice theory. You can do lots of things with it, which is reason alone to study. So how do we separate vortices and waves? Let's take a slightly, let's take a step back and look at our approach in general. So we have all possible configurations of our classical field psi, and we have to take a trace over that field in order to evaluate the partition function. If there are configurations that minimize the energy, they presumably will be dominant in the evaluation of this path integral. Right? So that's what the classical approximation is about, right? Or the mean field approximation is about. So let's think about configurations minimizing locally the energy. Can you name a few configurations that minimize the energy? So the energy is written like this, k over 2 d to r grad theta squared. Can you think of a configuration that minimizes this energy? Theta equal to a constant, right? Theta equal to a constant gives you an absolute minimum of energy. Certainly, this is the ground state. Any other configurations? That's not obvious, right? It turns out that vortices also minimize the energy, so which we will see shortly. Right, so if you minimize the energy, what you do is you just take the derivative, functional derivative with respect to the field, and you will get minus k times red squared theta. So any configuration where the Laplacian of theta is 0 will minimize the energy. Not just the uniform configurations, but also these configurations. Right, so let's look for configurations where grad squared theta is 0. In order to solve this problem, I'm going to use a trick. Represent grad theta with components partial x theta, partial y theta as a new vector, which I will call suggestively E. Essentially, it's a vector rotated 90 degrees from its original definition. The condition of 0 Laplacian of theta means partial x of partial y theta minus, sorry, translates into partial x of ey minus partial y of ex. Right? Or maybe there's a minus sign like this. So that's the condition of 0 curl of E. If the curl of E is 0, how can we represent it? As a gradient of something, right? So it means that E can be written as a gradient of something. And I suggestively will write this function as phi. See where I'm going? Where? Electrostatics, right? So there's some electrostatic problem here. So as long as you can write any configuration of this new electric field, it's going to minimize our energy. So one of them would be, for instance, the electric field of a point charge . So E would be like this. Sorry. It's Q times R divided by R squared in two dimensions. Right. And since E is basically the rotated gradient, in this case, Q is equal to 1. For a vortex, but you can also write vortices with a higher charge, as long as the charge is integer, right? Because the winding of the phase has to be, so this condition can be expressed like this. Let me not use this part and come back here. So remember how we define, so if you have a vortex, then as you go around the vortex and you calculate the change in theta as you go around this contour, this is the change in theta, right? And so this change in theta has to be 2 pi times q, where q is an integer. It cannot return to the same value plus pi, it has to return to the same value plus 2 pi times an integer, right? So if we translate this into our new language, grad theta is basically partial y, sorry, this is dy times dx minus dx times dy. Or is it the other way around? Yeah, it's the other way around. Which you can write as the integral where e is dotted with the following vector. This would be dy and minus dx. So if you think about what dy minus dx is, let's take our dr like this. That would be our dr. And then that vector dy minus dx would point in this direction. Will be just orthogonal to that. So that's minus dy and dx. So something is not quite right here. It's minus dy, actually. Is it? Should be minus dy. So it's dy and minus dx. Okay. So it's a vector that points normal to the contour. And so I can write this as an integral of e dot n, where n is the outer normal, times dr, which is basically the electric flux. And the electric flux is 2 pi times the charge. Okay. So q, which we can call the vorticity, 0 plus minus 1 plus minus 2 and so on, is known as the vorticity. And the analog in this electrostatic problem would be the electric charge. No. No, the energy of one vortex is larger than the ground state energy. The ground state energy is zero.
That's a local minimum.
Right, it's a local minimum, not a global one. So we'll get back to the energy. So a vortex located at R coordinates capital X, capital Y, and vorticity Q will have the following explicit form. So you can write it like this. E theta of R would be simply X minus capital X plus I times Y minus capital Y divided by the magnitude of this number. So in fact, it's easy to introduce a shorthand, Z minus capital Z divided by the absolute value of Z minus capital Z, where Z is the complex coordinate X plus IY, and capital Z is the complex coordinate for the location. This needs to be taken to the power Q. And so since this needs to be a single valued function, Q has to be an integer. Otherwise, if you start taking square roots or something like that, then this is not going to be single valued. But the wave function, which is basically this, right? So psi is going to be square root of n times that. So psi needs to be single valued. Theta itself need not be single valued. So the wonderful property of this vortex solution is that it minimizes the energy. beta u, and it will have energy if we evaluate it. It's going to be p times k times q squared times the logarithm of the ratio of the system size to the vortex core size. So it's proportional to q squared. So let me ask you, how come this is a local minimum of energy? What makes it stable? Clearly, the vacuum has a lower energy. Why does this thing not decay? What makes it stable?
Topology,
right? It has a different topology than the ground state. So in order to change from this state to the ground state, you'll have to make changes all over the place. You cannot go from one to the other just by making local changes. So it's the topology that guarantees that this is a stable solution. In fact, you have stable solutions in sectors with different q, right? So vortices with different q are in different topological sectors. Cannot be accessed or connected by local changes.
But for one vortex like that, why can't you just raise up the wave function at the origin?
Well, no. Just doing something at the origin is not enough because you have unmatching phases far away from the core. If you want to make
For one vortex.
Right? So the wave function is positive on this side and it's negative on that side. And you need both of them to be positive if you want to go to the ground state. So you'll have to make changes globally everywhere.
But the modulus squared of the wave function, that's quantity, you would only have to make changes.
But it's not just the modulus, right?
Yeah.
It's the phase also that we're thinking about.
Yeah.
So you cannot unwind the vortex just by making small changes. You'll need to make very big changes, and that's what guarantees it. Right?
But suppose we start with the vortices, let's say q equals to 2, will it decay to 2 vortices?
Right. It can decay into 2 vortices, but it still will be in a different sector than a single vortex.
Yeah, right. But it means that then it will not be.
Yes, that's a very good point. In fact, a double vortex is unstable against decaying into a pair of single vortices. The energy will go down. Yeah. But overall, the configuration is stable in the sense that you will still have 2 vortices, not 1. Not a single vortex. Okay. And you can also write down a very general expression for many vortices. So you can have e to I theta equal to the product over all different vortices located at different points, z minus zi divided by the absolute value of that to the power qi. So the product of these will be a superposition of vortices at different places. Okay. So this configuration still satisfies that condition.
Actually, I lost in the second equality. Like, how do you write down phi equal to b and c to the 2th power?
Right. So if you take a vortex at the origin, z divided by absolute value of z, and you square this thing, then the phase will increase by 4 pi as you go around. Right. So think of it as z times z. For each of the factors, the phase winds by 2 pi. For the combined one, it increases by 4 pi. So it's a vortex of double strength. Right. So it's additive for theta. Since it's in the exponential, right? So I just essentially added two vertices of the origin. So the speed with which theta is winding has doubled, right?
If the two vertices and one, if the number of vertices are different, like you say, what sectors are different?
The topological sector is given by the total charge.
Then, like, if I compare the time in the ground state, like, if there was no vertex at very low temperature, and if I slowly increase the temperature, like, then how can...
You will, so if you start with the ground state, which is uniform, and then you raise temperature, then you will obtain vortex anti-vortex pairs, so that the total vorticity would be zero. So in fact, one can make an argument that in an infinite system, if you have the net vorticity, there'll be an infinite energy. And so if you don't want that, then you might stick with only the Q equals zero sector, right? In which you have equal number of vortices and anti-vortices.
Does that mean you can think of the normal fluid state as like an infinite number?
Something like that. Yeah, there will be lots of vortices.
And just kind of make a normal fluid everywhere?
Yeah, yeah. But that's a very contorted description, right? It's, you know, it's hard to describe things in these terms. But yeah.
I'm just trying to think about how you recover the normal fluid.
Yeah. In fact, precisely this is what happens in the two-dimensional film of helium, as we'll see down the road. And okay. So we're interested in how vortices interact with one another, and this analogy with electrostatics suggests that the interactions will be just like in electrostatics, right?
Sorry, can you try to estimate the critical temperature by seeing, like, calculating what temperature you would create?
We'll get to that.
A number of, well, of vortices such that n times size is roughly the system size.
No, it's going to be a bit different. So we'll estimate the critical temperature, but it'll be a different estimate. So first we need to figure out how vortices interact with one another. Right? So the expression for the energy is this, right? It's grad theta squared integrated over space, which in our new notation is just E squared integrated over the volume. This is again like in the electrostatics. The energy of the electric field is E squared. The density is E squared, right? What other ways do you know of evaluating the energy of the electrostatic field? Assuming it comes from charges. Coulomb interaction, right? So this is going to be presumably some constant times the sum over pairs of vortices, I and J. The interaction, so product, so the interaction of vortex I and J. Maybe 1/2, because you can make a pair in two ways, ij and ji. What is the interaction of charges in one dimension? It's 1 over r, right? How about two dimensions? It's the logarithm of r, because the electric field decays as 1 over r. So when you integrate that over the distance, you get the logarithm, right? So it turns out that the interaction of two charges in this case would be minus 2 pi times k, k is our constant here, times the times qi, qj, and the logarithm of the distance between them, ri minus rj. Right, so let's see if this makes sense. If we have charges of the same sign, they should repel.
Can you please repeat how you get to that?
How I got to the logarithm? So the electric field So the electric field decays as Q divided by R in magnitude. Right. So if you calculate the electrostatic potential, it would be minus the integral of E dr. And so that's going to be minus Q log R. Right. So in two dimensions, your lines spread like this, right? So the electric flux is constant no matter what distance you go away from the charge. And so it the electric field strength should decay as 1 over R. In three dimensions, it's 1 over R squared. In two dimensions, it will be 1 over R. And so you get this. And so in fact, we can recover the results that we obtained for the energy of a single vortex in our disk of radius R using just that. Okay. So I will not stop to do that, but you can check that that's actually the case. And so that's the interaction of vortices. And so you can write your energy as minus pi k sum over I sum over j of qi qj times the logarithm of the distance between particles.
In the case of infinite system size, wouldn't this be unstable to separate the infinite?
It depends on what kind of vortices you have. If they're all of the same sign, of course, they will try to fly away from each other.
But you would eventually get lower than the ground state if you were infinite.
Ah, that's actually a very good question. So there should be some, it should not get lower than the ground state because this is positive definite, right? And so if you do the math correctly, then this is not going to be lower than the ground state energy.
Well, okay. But
So there may be some boundary terms that one generates in this way. Yeah, there should be some length here, but if your system has the total zero charge, you can see that this constant cancels out from your calculation. If you sum over all charges, right? So let's just focus on this term alone. We're going to have a sum over I and j, qi, qj times the logarithm of a, right? With a minus sign, so it's minus pi k. So that's just going to be minus pi k log a times the sum over I, qi, the sum over j, qj, and both of them are zero. If you're in the sector with total zero charge. If the charge is non-zero, then there is a contribution from infinity that you have to think about. Okay.
I don't see how any finite boundary terms would solve that problem. Can you make that arbitrarily negative?
Yeah, so that's the point, right? So if you imagine that your system is not infinite but finite, then the boundary will act like the opposing charge.
Right, but what about the infinite?
Yeah, well, so we never have an infinite system, right? So we have a finite system. And let's say there is a huge charge in the system, so the electric field goes radially out like this, right? But the electric field does not extend beyond the system edge, which means that the edge must have the negative charge minus Q. So the net charge is still zero. So you will not be able to do that. So this negative charge represents the boundary term. Okay. Well, we can try and pick holes in this argument, but let's do something more productive. Let's actually develop theory further. We can poke holes in our spare time. So here's the formal construction that allows you to separate your thermal fluctuations into waves and vortices. So first, if you have electric charges, then the Laplacian of the electrostatic potential is going to be minus 2 pi times the sum of the charge densities, which are located at isolated points. In three dimensions, you would have 4 pi here. In two dimensions, you have 2 pi. These are the areas of unit circles or unit spheres in the corresponding number of dimensions. Right. And translating this back to our angular variable theta, this means that the curl of the gradient is 0 except at the locations of the vortices. And so that's another way of saying that if you circle a vortex, then the phase increases by 2 pi, or by 2 pi times q, where q is the vorticity. So we have that. So our formal construction for separating theta into vortices and smooth waves proceeds as follows. So you take whatever configuration theta of r you have. Right? It'll be waves and vortices, or maybe just waves, or maybe just vortices, or superposition thereof. What you can do in this case, you can find out where the vortex cores are. How do you do that? Yeah, you have to encircle every point in space with a little contour and check whether or not there is a winding of the phase, right, by 2 pi times q. So find the vortex cores, which will be characterized by winding numbers qi and positions ri. Then you construct an ideal vortex solution from these data, using these QIs and RIs. And that has been just done right there. So that's our ideal vortex solution. Right? So with grad squared theta equal to 0 and the curl of the gradient equal to that, right? So 2 pi times the sum of ri qi delta of ri. The remainder is just waves, right? Because in the remainder, which we will call theta waves, this theta minus this idealized vortex solution, you will have the curl of the gradient equal to 0, right? Which means that theta is single valued there. No matter where you encircle a point, theta is going to be single valued, right? So that's how you separate your angular variable in these two parts. So now it remains to write down the energy of our general configuration, which includes apart from vortices and apart from waves. Right? So there will be three parts to it. It's the energy of the vortices. So we know how to do this. Right? So it's the energy of their Coulomb interaction. Idealized vortices interact in this way. Then there'll be the energy of spin waves. Sorry, just waves. I keep saying spin waves, don't I? Just the energy of waves alone. Tutorial 8. And finally, there's the interaction energy of the vortices and the waves. So we need to show that this term is absent. How would you approach this? When in doubt, integrate by parts. So we integrate by parts, and this becomes k times theta vortices grad squared theta waves. Or no, the other way around. Theta waves, grad squared theta vortices. The other expression makes no sense, actually. This one does, because theta vortex is well, is theta waves is well defined. Single valued. So we can write this expression. And what about theta squared of theta for vortices? It's zero, right? Because it minimizes the energy. There's no singularity, right? Any vortex solution satisfies this. The singularities are in the curl of the gradient, but not in the Laplacian. Right? That's where the singularities are. So we have it somewhere up there. Singular, this is not singular. So this thing vanishes, and therefore this part of interaction is just zero. And so we've separated our energy neatly into the energy of waves and the energy of vortices, which form what one might call a Coulomb gas, because these are just electric charges interacting with one another like this. So the fate of this Coulomb gas would depend on temperature, right?
The analysis we did yesterday was at temperature equal to 0, right?
Yeah, we did it at zero temperature, but one can do it at a finite temperature as well. So this is done at a finite temperature, right? Yeah. Yeah, so what you should honestly do at a finite temperature is evaluate that path integral that I wrote at the beginning. Right, at zero temperature, it'll be an infinite imaginary time direction. At a finite temperature, it'll be a finite imaginary time direction. So we've simplified the problem by saying, well, let's forget about the time dependence in that direction and just concentrate on the classical field theory. This is what we're doing.
It doesn't have to be below the Bose condensation temperature.
It does, it does. It has to be below the Bose condensation temperature. Okay, so the fate of our system will be as follows. At zero temperature, there'll be no vortices. You'll be just in the ground state. As you raise the temperature, you will have vortices appearing, and they will appear in vortex anti-vortex pairs. Because if you start with the ground state, you're staying in the same topological sector, so you're going to end up with the same number of vortices and anti-vortices, unless vortices enter from the boundary. In that case, you can change the topological sector. But let's not think about that. So at low temperatures, the vortex concentration will be small, and it will increase as the temperature goes up. And one can make an estimate at which point the vortices will be numerous. And so here's how it's going to work. Let's think about a single pair of vortices, just one. with equal and opposite charges. Because if you start with the vacuum, you can only create a pair of vortices with equal and opposite charges. So it's a pair of vortices, charges Q and minus Q. Their interaction energy is going to be minus pi k times, 2 pi k times q and minus q times the logarithm of the distance between them, r1 minus r2. Well, let's just call this r. Right, so if you evaluate the probability of this configuration, it's going to be e to minus beta u. So the minuses will cancel out here, and we will have the exponential of minus 2 pi k q squared log r. Well, if we have the logarithm and the exponential, this is a power, right? So it's going to be 1 divided by r to the power 2 pi q squared k. You try to normalize your probability, right, so it's d to r. The probability d to r would be this. It's d to r 1 over r to 2 pi q squared k. So it's dr divided by r to 2 pi q squared k minus 1. So if k is large, this will converge at the upper level, right? So we integrate presumably from c to the system size r. So if you think about this, if k is large, then this is going to be dominated by the short distances, right? It'll be a large power in the denominator. So things will be dominated by the short distance physics. And if k is small, then it's going to be dominated by the long distance physics, which is another way of saying that your vortices spend a lot of time either close to each other or far apart. And the change from one behavior to the other happens when this number goes through 1. Right? Dr over r is the logarithm, and so that's the boundary. So the change occurs from short distance physics which means that the distance is roughly psi to long distance physics the separation is of order of the system size, so you go from bound charges to free charges, happens at 2 pi q squared k minus 1 equal to 1. All right, so you need the coupling constant to be 1 divided by pi q squared. And I guess that's that, right? So as you start at low temperatures, your coupling constant is strong, right? Remember, the coupling constant is the ratio of energy to temperature. And so the coupling constant is large. And if you draw the temperature axis here, or the coupling constant axis, right? So k, this is infinity, this is 0, And temperature-wise, it's the other way around. All right, so you're at low temperatures, then you have a large coupling constant. So let's put these numbers on this axis, right? So there'll be number 1 over pi, 1 over 4 pi, 1 over 9 pi. So as you go from low temperatures to high temperatures, the first thing that happens is pairs of single vortices unbind. So they become free. And then if you were able to go up to this point, then double vortices would unbind. But it's not interesting because the transition has already happened. So we're not interested in the rest of these critical points. So this very simple consideration that just deals with a pair of vortices indicates there is an interesting transition. It has nothing to do with change in symmetry or something like that. It's just the transition at which topological defects unbind. At low temperatures, they were tightly bound to one another, right? So a vortex and an antivortex could only appear at a microscopic distance. And if you didn't look under a microscope, you wouldn't even see these vortices. So vortices are absent at low temperatures. And you can only take into account gentle waves, and you'll be done. But as you raise the temperature, eventually vortices start moving apart, and they break free. And once they break free, the system becomes extremely disordered because vortices running around scramble the phase very effectively. So that's the nature of the phase transition into spatial dimensions. And the full theory of this would take another lecture using the renormalization group framework. I'll just mention that the theory of this phase transition was put together by Berezinski in the Soviet Union and Kostelitz and Daroulas in the US. And it's a marvelous theory, another marvelous theory.
The work actually of vortices very convincing experiments you have to experiments on dimensional.
So vortices are not easy to observe in a superfluid. But you can measure what's called the superfluid density, which is roughly speaking the following experiment. What you need to do is take your system and introduce the gradient of the phase. So by changing the phase from theta 1 to theta 2 here, and then the gradient of theta would be just the difference of these divided by the width of the system. And then the energy of the system presumably will increase in proportion to grad theta squared. So the energy would be beta u, something like k over 2 times gradient squared times the cross section, L and W. All right, so this is length and width. And so what happens in this experiment, if you use this Coulomb analogy, creating a gradient in this direction is equivalent to having an electric field in that direction. Right, so there's an electric field here. And vortices being electric charges will create a polarization in the opposite direction. Right, so if you have tightly bound vertices, you will have positive charges slightly offset vertically relative to the negative charges. Right? Like in a dielectric, your medium will be slightly polarized, and so the electric field will be reduced somewhat. And so your stiffness will actually not be this, but it will be slightly smaller than k. We're normalized by the presence of these vortex pairs. When these vortex pairs unbind, the positive vortices can just flow toward the upper edge, where presumably you have electric charges, or sorry, these would be negative, or these would be positive and these would be negative, right? So it's the other way around. And so here it's negative charge going up and positive charge going down. So the negative charges will just flow all the way, and they will completely screen these charges. And the positive charges will completely screen those charges. So there'll be no stiffness at all. Because the electric field will vanish, there'll be no energy cost at all. So the presence of these unbound vortices is actually very important, right? It makes the superfluid completely normal in this analogy. So it's easier to understand this using the electrostatic analogy than to think in terms of phases.
Okay, so essentially your argument, you're saying is you decrease K from infinity when it passes through 1 over pi, this integral
yeah.
will be dominated by a large R.
Yeah, so it means that it's more likely for the vortices to be far apart than to be close together.
Why does that mean, what does it mean that the vortices are unbound?
Okay, so the probability is written over here. This is the probability distribution, right? So depending on the power, if it's a large power, like 1 over r to the 10th, mm-hmm. right? It's dominated by the short distance n. And your vortices will likely be very close together. But once the power goes below 1, the tail will dominate. The long distance tail will be dominant, right? So your particles will likely be found very far apart, which means that they're effectively free. It didn't change, but what you have changed is you've gone from a dielectric where you had charges that were able to be polarized a bit, right, pulled apart a little bit, to a plasma, which conducts. And although the interactions would be the same, if you introduce a test charge into the system, it'll be completely screened by the free charges, right? Like in a metal. A metal is a plasma, essentially. So it's a phase transition between a dielectric and a plasma. That's what the Costello-Dallas transition is like. And they have very different electrical properties, right? Okay. If you guys have no further questions right now, we're done. But feel free to come and ask them.